This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you, Jean-Michel and Aaron. I really want to thank all of you for coming tonight and letting me share this material with you. Yes, Jean-Michel mentioned that I've been invited after many discussions with the Zimmerli staff to organize an exhibition there in a couple of years that will feature art that's never been seen before. And what I'd like to do tonight is talk to you a little bit about the rationale for the show and run you through a kind of narrative about or exhibition history of this material starting in 1974. And so without any further ado, I'm just going to start. I have a number of images to show you. Some of them are familiar, and others will be completely new to you. But the fundamental point I'm going to try to make tonight is that there is a kind of binary set of opposites that the Nazis themselves established as the way to view modern art. And we're familiar with these binaries. There is the modernism, which the Nazis derided as degenerate, and then there's Nazi art. And the place where the first set of binaries was unveiled was the House of German Art, which was, of course, a production of the Trost Atelier, there is a contemporary image. And I'm going to show you a couple of images of the vernissage of the 37 show. And the thing is that there were, of course, we know this backstory, there were two shows that opened simultaneously in Munich, and they set up this opposition. And it's this opposition that I'm going to call into question, or is called into question, by the materials I found. And again, just to go back to this very briefly, over a period of years, I discovered that there are about 10,000 works which had been confiscated by the United States Army, but had not been seen. And several thousand of them had been completely gone off the radar screen that neither the German government nor the American government could tell me precisely where they were. And after a period of years, I actually managed to find them and photograph them. And so some of the photographs will be not a little bit less good in quality just because they're mine. And there's no other reproductions. So here we have images that we're familiar with, these photographs of some of the principal architects of cultural policy in the Third Reich. Of course, there's the widow of the architect Gerdy Troost. Of course, Hitler, whose vision of this antipathetic relationship between modernism and sort of what we'll call Nazi modernism or Nazi culture was first articulated. And here, of course, Goebbels. And this is Adolf Ziegler, a crucial individual in the articulation of this ideology, because he was the organizer of the first degenerate art exhibition, which opened shortly after this one, and also was an artist himself whose works were included in the initial show. I wanted us to pay attention to the Prometheus here of Breaker, because we're going to see a lot of it tonight. It's one of the favorite kind of images sculptures, objects to include in shows attempting to reconstruct the aesthetic of the Third Reich. Here we have the one of the main donors to the House of German Art. One of the things that people don't normally realize is that the House of German Art was not built by the government or with government funds, but actually from party funds or from donors. And one of the interesting things that's happened in recent years is that Chris Durkin, the director of the House of Art, actually found the donor plaque and has remounted it in the museum. But August von Finck is the man in the middle there, and he was the kind of honorary curator of the exhibition. Sorry, here we go. This is then the pendant show, the degenerate art exhibition, which we know the backstory to, traveled all around the country. It may still have this the record for the most number of visitors in the 20th century, millions attended. Right, this is a shot inside the exhibition itself. This is the installation ridiculing Emil Nolde's work, the great irony, of course, is Nolde was an early party member. And so this was one of these paradoxes of the attack on classical modernism, that one of their own was actually chosen to be an exemplar of that. Then we switch to immediately after the war. This would have been in April or May 1945. This is a photograph of the Alt Aussee salt mine, which the Nazis had been using as a depot for the Linz collection and other works associated with the party leadership. It also was a place where contemporary German art was stored. And so one of the things that's not told, let's say, in the great narrative of Lynn Nicholas's, or even in the film that was produced last year on the book, The Rape of Europa, there's no discussion in either Nicholas's book or in the film of the confiscation of contemporary German art. And this is where my narrative sort of in the Invisible Museum, which is forthcoming from Yale, comes in. We mourn the passing of Craig Hugh Smyth last year. He was the MFANA, Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives Unit officer who established the central collecting point in Munich, and this was ironically the Verwaltungsbau, the administration building of the Nazi Party, which was intact and was requisitioned by the army. And after some struggle with Patton's subordinates, Craig Hugh Smyth was able to use this building to receive and to register the objects found in Alt Aussee and other places in Germany. And this, of course, is a photograph of the works that were found. And I want to distinguish now between the works that were salvaged and restituted to the countries the Nazis occupied, and then my side of the story. Little known thing is that 700 works of contemporary German art were found in various places, in public buildings in Munich, or in hidden repositories. And these 700 works formed the kind of nucleus of all the things we currently know. All the works that are reproduced by scholars, that are shown in exhibitions, are drawn from these 700 works that we now call the National Socialist State Property Collection. NS Reichsbesitz is what it's called. But what's not really understood is that these pictures were taken as a punitive action against artists. They were not. Artists had to submit a Fragenbogen or a questionnaire in order to receive property back. And if their own party affiliation or their activities during the Third Reich were such, these properties would not be returned to them. And even if they were clean, in a sense, politically, if the works were determined by the Allied property control officers to reflect National Socialist aesthetics or symbolism, they were retained anyway. So this is the origin of this 700-piece collection that we all know. This is an example of a work, a profile portrait of Hitler by an artist named Konrad Hummel. You can see the registration number here. This is the official registration photograph in the central collecting point for this work. This work then found its way to Washington after the war because of a second, as did these works, which are actually in the possession of Heinrich Hoffmann, the official photographer of the regime. These are watercolors, authenticated watercolors by Hitler himself, which he had given to Hoffmann as presents. These were confiscated, and they were also sent to Washington as a result of another confiscation action which I'm going to talk about now. This is a well-known image, Richard Heimann's Sonniges Leben, or this sunny life, whatever you want to call it. It's very well known and a frequently exhibited object. We'll see plenty of this again tonight as we go into the history of the exhibition of this material. But they belong to the 700-piece state National Socialist State Property Collection. This is another image of Albrecht Janisch's Wassersport, is well known. This is Arthur Kampf's The Virgin of Hemmingstedt, or the Virgin Telsche in the battle by Hemmingstedt in 1500. I shot this in depot. This is, again, a well-known image, frequently appearing in exhibitions. This one as well. Martin Amerbach's The Sower. These images today, these 700 images now are held in the German Historical Museum after many years of their being sort of in a kind of bizarre limbo in Munich. This is, in fact, Ziegler. Sorry, I'll go back to that. That's a work by Ziegler that Hitler himself purchased. It's nude for 10,000 Reichsmarks. And you kind of have to figure 4 Reichsmarks to the dollar at that time, or two. I think that's around that range. The Soliger, the Judgment of Paris, is also among these 700. You're going to recognize some of these, I think, from if you've seen any scholarly material produced on this period. Now we're going to switch to another exhibition. This was held in the, at that time, still intact Städtisches Kunstinstitut in Frankfurt, starting on December 7th, 1946. And this is the program for the catalog of a very limited little show that was held, sponsored by the U.S. Army, to reveal just the tip of the iceberg of the nearly 10,000 objects which were confiscated in the preceding 6 months or so in 1946. It's an interesting photograph because here you have the officer in charge of this confiscation action, officer in the U.S. Army Air Force named Gordon Gilkey, and his boss is over here, a colonel who's in charge of the Historical Properties Division of the Army. But this fellow is an interesting character. He is General Joseph P. McNarney. He replaced Eisenhower as the chief commander-in-chief, supreme commander of the Allied forces in Europe, and he attended this as well. And they're looking at a big painting, which we'll include in the show at the Zimmerli by Emil Scheibe. It's a fascinating group portrait that's been misinterpreted by a lot of scholars. It's going to appear in an exhibition at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum very shortly, but I'm afraid it's going to take on the traditional interpretation that this is actually kind of a celebratory ideology soaked image, but I think it's actually much more interesting than that. But I've taken a few shots of this in the depot in Washington. It's sort of not a great image, but they're surrounding the man they've come to see. But over in this detailed shot, you have a self-portrait of the artist Emil Scheibe, who went on to have a very splashy career in the post-war era in Germany. But you can, I consider this to be a prime example of a kind of subversive picture that, in terms of genre, corresponds to expectations, but actually employs a lot of new objectivity techniques. It's kind of mocking in places. Some of the figures are clearly drunk or intoxicated, if not by liquor, then by the presence of their leader. It's really a puzzling and interesting picture. Right. Here we go. These are some shy, actually acquired photographs of the installation of the show in the Städtl. And we see that here we have it was deemed missing for many years. This is the center panel of a big and important triptych by the artist Schmitz Wiedenbruck. And we found this in the Army depot in Washington. We were able to include it in the Kunst und Propaganda show in Berlin. The Germans had were the right and left wings of the triptych. We found the middle part, which depicts members of the armed forces. And another important image that was confiscated by the American officer Gilkey was this one here, East Front fighters. I'm not that interested in this one because, of course, it was confiscated because it. And not returned to Germany. One of the other things that you need to know is that in 1951 and then 1986, the United States returned most of these 10,000 images to the Germans. We retained a number of them, including this one and the preceding one, because of their political content. This one is well known, of course, and this was included in Berlin as well. In fact, you can't do a show on Art of the Third Reich without the Lanzinger picture. And the fascinating thing about it is that it has acquired a kind of alternate title in German, Der Bahnenträger, the banner carrier or whatever, but its original title in 1937 was the Guardian of German Art. So it was exhibited in the initial exhibition of the Great German Art Exhibition in the Haus der Deutschen Kunst. And so it really has that connotation and hence the imagery. This is another one of the works retained in Washington. Said before, Gilkey confiscated a total of 9,250 works of art, and they were held in two main U.S. facilities in Munich, the Verwaltungsbau, and then the main offices of the former offices of the IG Farben in Frankfurt, which was also requisitioned by the U.S. Army until they were shipped to the U.S. between 47 and 49, these 9,000-plus works. Gilkey was an interesting figure, a minor artist of some repute in the printmaking world. This is Gilkey boarding an aircraft, a kind of a publicity photo. This is his job in the States was to train pilots how to read aerial photographs to sort of determine what there is down there to bomb. And as the war was coming to an end, he sought to be transferred to the European Theater of Operations. He tried first to be hired as a war artist, but we had a kind of a fledgling program. It was much more developed in the Pacific Theater than on the in Europe. And when that failed, he tried to be assigned to the Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives units. That failing that, he agreed to be assigned the job of confiscating art, which was kind of the opposite of what the MFA and A people were doing, but he accepted it nonetheless. And this is a eureka moment where Gilkey is standing between. This is the German officer in civilian clothing who had led Gilkey to this hut on the border between Bavaria and the Czech Republic. And this Jeep is filled with, or it's actually two vehicles here filled with the paintings that were hidden in this hut. And it's comprised the majority of these works. And this officer had gone from Munich and gathered things up in Berlin and brought them down here and was hiding out trying to protect these works. This was the whole idea. And Gilkey negotiated a release in his custody of these things. This is just to illustrate the fact that Gilkey was a printmaker and art teacher before the war and after the war as well. And this is an image taken of him, photograph taken of him at the his job where he taught in the States before the war. He's best known for a work he produced as a fairly young man, the official etchings recording the 1939 World's Fair and in New York. And this is an example, once we get there, of this is the GM Pavilion in the New York World's Fair. And this is one of the number of etchings in the collection. Interestingly enough, Gilkey didn't stay in New York, went out to the Midwest, and then went to Europe. And after his job was done in occupied Germany, he returned to the States and he eventually became the founding dean of the graduate school at Oregon State University. He also founded the Northwest Print Society and became a very important player in printmaking culture in the United States. And he even founded the Portland Art Museum's Gilkey Center for Graphic Art. And so he has a kind of a minor player in arts education and even and arts and academic administration in the United States. So we flash forward now. The works are here in the States, most of them until early 50s when about 1,700 were sent back to Germany. And then for a couple of decades, nothing happened. Meanwhile, this 700-piece collection that was established with the works of art we recognize was left in Germany, but under American authority. It was an odd kind of arrangement. But in 1964, these works were released to the Germans. And a decade later, the first attempt to show these works was launched in 1974. This was the show that launched these objects. Kunst im Dritten Reich, Dokumente der Unterwerfung, Documents of Subjugation, I guess is one way of translating that. And this exhibition unveiled these works with heavy contextualization for the first time since they were shown in the 40s at the Haus der Deutschen Kunst. And what this show did was to establish the suggestion, anyway, that these works constituted the canon of work produced in the Third Reich. And from that point on, every successive show, well, that the rest of my talk is based on the repetition of this notion of the Nazi canon. And these are works that were exhibited at the show. This is Oscar Martin Ammerbach's The Sower, again, a work that we'll see a few more times tonight. Right, and then at the same time in 1974, Berthold Hintz published the first serious scholarly treatment of the field. Die Malerei im deutschen Faschismus, Kunst und Revolution, it's a very Counterrevolution, a very interesting book, but it established kind of the parameters for discussing this material, that Nazi works were in essence anti-modernist, and so we have modernist anti-modernist as this kind of this kind of binary. It's an important work. But again, he's basing his argument, his thesis, on the 700 piece or of also on photographs of works that don't permit the scholar to see the surfaces of the paintings, just photographs, right? And I just want to show a few examples of works that are reproduced and discussed in Hinz's book, and they're works that were exhibited in the Kunst im Dritten Reich and in every successive show. Some of these you may recognize. Von Zügel's Herd of Cattle in the Flood, Siebert's My Comrades in Poland, and then this astonishing thing. I chose these because they represent the most, what we consider to be the canonical appearance of these works, okay? But they're a little extreme for because that's the assumption. Then another decade and a half passes, and the works, about 7,000 works, after a lot of very fraught negotiation between the United States government and West Germany, as well as kind of internecine argument within the U.S. government, we agreed to return about 7,000 pictures to Germany. The public awareness of this return coincided with a kind of tempest in a teapot that some of you might remember when Peter Ludwig, who's a very wealthy chocolate manufacturer, commissioned Arnold Breker to produce portrait busts of himself and his wife. It wouldn't have been a big deal. Breker had always had private clients ever since the end of World War II. He was very popular, in fact, as an artist. But the trouble was Ludwig had founded the Museum Ludwig in Cologne. It was of modern art. And he was going to install these busts at the entranceway. Okay, so this let loose the controversy that Klaus Steich called Nazi Kunst ins Museum, which is the title from where I've taken the title for my talk tonight. It's not a great photograph, but here you have Breker and Ludwig viewing, I suppose, the finished products, or at least plaster casts of what would soon be the finished products. And so the trouble with the return of these works of art, the Americans had stipulated these would be returned to Germany for educational purposes, and that they were to be used in a pedagogical way and then returned to the artists. That was what the Americans stipulated. The Germans received these works and did nothing of the sort. Even the Greens led some initiative to try to make them visible to the public, but that was shot down. Remember, the Greens came into prominence like 85, 84, 85, 86, and one of the things that they were really interested in was seeing these works, and that was not done. And the debate that sort of coincided with the debate over the Ludwig scandal was whether or not these works should be made available or not. But because none of the returned objects were exhibited, the arguments in Steich's collection, Nazi Kunst ins Museum, revolve around the same limited pool of objects that had first been unveiled in 1974 at the exhibition Kunst im Dritten Reich. And so Steich's contributors persist in maintaining this dualism between modernist art and Nazi art, and that, again, which has been in place for more than a decade at that point. Then another important moment, I think, in the reception of this material was Stephanie Barron's 1991 show at LACMA, Degenerate Art, the Fate of the Avant-Garde in Nazi Germany. This historically important reconstruction of the original 1937 Degenerate Art exhibition nonetheless perpetuated the idea of a binary opposition between modernism and Nazi art. And of course, one of the few objects that are actually one of the few objects included in the book was this astonishing thing by Torach, Kameraden. You couldn't select anything more, extreme Nazi than this. And so the terms of the argument in Barron's collection and exhibition are just rather extreme. It's either this or classical modernism and nothing in between. We view almost nothing else in the, and that these were, this is this piece was lost, but there was absolutely no, there were no physical objects that we could see or compare to the pieces reconstructed in her show. And then we go to a rather bizarre and fascinating little institution, the Wolfsonian in Miami Beach, founded in 1986. And then I wanted to show you an image of the catalog of the permanent exhibition, which was published in 1995. The attempt was made to contextualize Nazi design in an international way. This is an important resource, definitely an important resource for visual culture of the first half of the 20th century, the Wilsonian is. But the examples shown in the catalog reflect the prevailing notions that we've already discussed. Even though there is material in the Wilsonian where I've gone a few times to work that would support the existence of what Jeffrey Herf might call reactionary modernism, or in a recent book published by Roger Griffin, this where he seeks to find examples of and discuss the importance of examples of Nazi modernism. Again, in this catalog, there was what was published were images like this of the Soliger's double nude, which perpetuate the same, or these two posters by Ludwig Holbein that, again, perpetuate our standard understanding of what was possible in the realm of cultural production in the Third Reich. Very interesting show then that opened in 1996 in London was Art and Power. This exhibition focused on the national pavilions of fascist Spain, Nazi Germany, the Soviet Union, and fascist Italy at the 37 Paris International Exposition. It was sort of the jumping off point for that. But again, the pictures that were represented in the catalog include the Artur Kampf Venus and Adonis, which is a very, we're going to see in a moment, was meant to be an example of what was possible in the Third Reich, as was Janisch's Wassersport, which is one of the showpieces in the catalog, one of the plates in the catalog. Then there was this extraordinary moment in 1999 when Weimar was the designated the European Cultural Capital of the Year, and it was fascinating because Achim Preiss, who teaches at the Bauhaus University, must have had a lot of resources because he threw together this exhibition, The Rise and Fall of Modernism, where he linked examples of the degenerate modernist art persecuted by the Nazis, and then examples also of East German art. And then on top of it, he chose the largest selection of works that had belonged to the 700-piece National Socialist State Property Collection, had them prepared for exhibition. And these are some photographs from that exhibition. And you can see, sorry, I'll get back there, because there are, again, I want to point out that the selection of objects was such that it reminds us of the things we've already seen before. Here we go. In this slide, we see here's the Virgin of Hemingstedt. Once again, can't have an exhibition without it. Come on. Here's the Venus and Adonis, right there. And then back here, you have the two Soliger nerds, a Judgment of Paris, right in the center there. But despite the fanfare about this, it really showed us nothing new. It was simply a kind of a redoing of the 1974 exhibition. Another show that opened in 2000 had real potential. This was Deutsche Kunst in Braunschweig. It was an attempt to represent the regional kind of take on art in the Third Reich. Instead of, I don't know, digging very deeply, once again, the main objects featured in the show were familiar ones. This is an artist, Adolf Wissel, an important kind of portraitist, That work was lost. This one we still have. In the Braunschweig exhibition, no evidence is offered for any other model for artistic production in the Third Reich and the firmly entrenched opposition between modernist and Nazi art. So we're left asking ourselves, what else is there? In 2001, 2002, Taking Positions, which is about to come up here, Figurative Sculpture in the Third Reich opened at the Henry Moore Institute and traveled to Germany. And this exhibition featured sculptures by Karl Albiker, Hermann Blumenthal, Arno Breker, Fritz Klimsch, Georg Kolbe, and Richard Scheibe. And it created a certain amount of stir and a lot of negative publicity in Germany because it had broken a taboo. The taboo that had been established since 1974 was that there would be none of this material exhibited in art museums. Only in history museums could this material be shown. And after the show in 2001, 2002, this orthodoxy seemed to stay in, remain intact until last year's show of Breker sculptures in the little museum in Schwerin, the Stadtmuseum in Schwerin. This is a Kolbe. The previous was a Breker in the Taking Positions show. And I want to show you just the covers of some recent, of the best recent scholarship. Michaud's book is justly admired, his interpretation of the place of Nazi art in the psychology of Germany is fantastic. But once again, one shortcoming I would suggest is that Michaud is still working from the same limited pool of objects. And so the conclusions, as sophisticated and as intelligent as they are, again, are based on a limited range of what was possible in the Third Reich. This is a collection published by Hans Sachowitz a few years ago. Hitler's Artists, the Culture in the Service, Culture in the Service of National Socialism. And then from a year ago, or 2 years ago, Peter Reichel's Der schöne Schein des Dritten Reichs, the beautiful illusion, one could, I suppose, just translate it as, of the Third Reich, power and fascination of the German fascism. Again, a great, well-written, well-researched book, but it focuses on these same images that we're familiar with. And then, I must say, I was working as a consultant and contributing curator to art and propaganda at the German Historical Museum. An extraordinary opportunity. They spent a couple of million euros, and the whole, on this show, the whole point of the exhibition was to construct a four-way comparison between Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, the Soviet Union, and this was the part that really drove the German press crazy, New Deal America. We wanted to compare sort of strategies of national propaganda during this time. And I was responsible for curating what they called the Schlussraum, the last room in the exhibition, which reconstructed the post-war disposition of these works that I found. And my intention was to include paintings in the exhibition, in my part of the exhibition, would contradict this established binary opposition. But the curators of the museum wouldn't hear of it. They would not allow me to select more painterly examples because, once again, we are sort of locked into and really invested in this oppositional kind of way of looking at works of art. So these are some photographs I took. This is from photographs I took of the installation period. You can see here, of course, we have the Prometheus again. We have the Heimann, Zoniges Leben there. We have an example here of some propaganda posters, but the point is that we were reconstructing the installations of other shows. And people felt good about it because they could say, yes, that's Nazi art, boom, boom, boom. We included the Soliger's Judgment of Paris. You know, we couldn't have a show without it. We also included the Schirmherr der Deutsche Kunst by Lanzinger, which Barry Bergdahl came through at one point. We gave him a little tour. After he saw this picture, I probably wouldn't mind my saying this, he's close up, because it's actually quite impressive and different from most reproductions. He said, I thought Nazi art wasn't supposed to be good. So I appreciated that one because it suggested that even in the repetition of images, we were able to actually suggest something that had not been suggested before. This is another Kunstzeitschrift in the Trenches, another work that belongs to the long list of works that we've all seen before. Well, now we go back a little bit in time to my discovery phase, and I found the 1700 works returned in 1951 in a remarkable situation. They were actually held in a facility in far eastern Berlin. The facility was called the Bundesamt für Strahlenschutz, or something like the Federal Department for Atomic Security. But there was held the remnant of the Linz collection, those works that had been found by the MFANA, but over the decades had not been returned to, they couldn't find ownership for these works. And in addition to that, I found there the 1700 works that had been returned in 51. And no one had seen them before, no photographs existed of them, and no one had studied them. And so here I was given an opportunity. You can imagine my surprise when one of the first works I pulled out of this, out of the drawer was this, a little watercolor by Fritz Junghans, which I thought, well, it could be a Haeckel, it could be any number of things from the by a degenerate artist. The surprises continued after that point, and I have to describe what it was like. There's a kind of Chinese box sort of structure of German bureaucracies with respect to art properties. And since I first took these photographs a few years ago, the responsibility for these pictures has changed several times. And so each time I try to look for them again, I have to go through a different channel or go to different people. But when I was there, each time I was there, I would ask permission to photograph them, and I was permitted to do it, which is sort of extraordinary, and their backs, because the backs tell the story of the picture, the provenance of the pictures as well. Because there would be stickers indicating ownership of them, where they'd been sold, who had purchased them, where they'd been hung before they were confiscated. And the other thing about the pictures that was surprising is that one got the impression that one was not permitted to depict the impact of Allied bombing in Germany, except in a kind of heroic way. And this was an interesting picture, I thought, because it depicts the ruins of Lübeck after the firebombing. And besides having a kind of not particularly court artly style, it depicts an image, a kind of image that one would have thought would actually be illegal at the time. This is an image by an artist of whom there are dozens and dozens of works in this collection, named Widmann. This is just a little landscape in Italy. His works were quite a revelation to me. And the thing about them is these were not, keep in mind, these were not done secretly. These were not done on the sly. They have, if you can look here, there you can see some bleed through of a stamp, an official stamp there in the corner, as they'd be stamped on the back, indicating his unit, propaganda unit he belonged to. And then the Americans also added their own stamps on the back, so you could tell which ones had actually been produced under the aegis of a certain program, as well as what their provenance would be after the moment they were produced and then sold. This is by an artist named Helmut Georg. And pictures like this take on a certain shock value when we consider what the official line was on Impressionism and Post-Impressionism. Remember what Goebbels says about Van Gogh, how sad it was that Van Gogh was no-go because he liked him so much. And so we ask ourselves, well, if artists like this were working freely and selling their works in the Third Reich, then what about this, the rhetoric, and what about the binary opposition? This artist is an interesting case. Hengstenberg studied in Paris and with Cubist, and was like Breker himself, a self-identified Cubist in the 20s. And you can even see in this is just one of number of his works in the collection. You can see the influence of his teachers in works like this, or in this landscape by Hengstenberg in Crimea. Now, of course, one does not want to neglect to mention that these landscapes are haunted. They seem innocent, or they might seem quasi-modernist in technique. We have to remember, too, that they're haunted by the acts that occurred in the vicinity where these artists were working, whether it was attacks on the local population or combat. It's an artist named Meyer who's an interesting case. It's just an abstract landscape. And this is another one by Meyer. It's an etching, this whole series of etchings. I have a few of them for you here. This is a female figure. This is an interesting one because it's a medic or a sanitator and a wounded guy here. And here, of course, these notations were made by the American officer who wrote on them. This was his registration number. Here is his initials, and even scribbled the name of the artist right onto the etching. And then the backs are stamped with U.S. government property. This is another one by Meyer. And this was published in an official series of etchings by the Wehrmacht. So this was, again, something that the Wehrmacht supported. It wasn't something sort of done independent of the... And they would turn... They worked for an organization called the Staff of Visual Artists. They were permitted to go out in the field and make sketches, and they would spend months at a time in Potsdam in the central headquarters producing studio versions of their sketches, which they could then sell. And so the works that I found are a mixture of both the completed works as well as sketches taken in the field. This is one by an artist named Otto Meister. This is Mount Olympus in the rain. This one also seems rather innocent, but it's the site of a vicious battle between German paratroopers and British defenders on Crimea. But it's a grove of olive trees on Crete. Crete, not Crimea. But the actual official title is on the back, and the artist, Grobner was his name, documents the actual units involved in the battle. The Germans prevailed in this case. It's an artist named Züchtig, whose works you can buy through ArtNet or something like that today, or you look them up. He was a kind of a post-impressionist landscape artist who was also attached to a war propaganda unit during the war. This artist is named Ulrich Ertel, and this is called Deliverance Mountain in Norway. There are a couple of other images of Ertel's here that I found in the Agency for Atomic Security. And he had been a student of Munch's pre-war, and so he was assigned to Norway as his beat. It was sort of interesting, and he found his perfect subject matter there. This is by an artist named Schmuck. This is a street scene in Saloniki, and of course one can't but be aware of the deportation of the Jews from Saloniki and read about them in This Way to the Gas, Ladies and Gentlemen. You know, an astonishingly horrible sort of narrative, and yet that kind of image reminds you that, sort of bizarre normalcy at the same time. Now, there's a second phase of discovery. After finding those 1,700 pictures in Berlin, I then stumbled upon the 7,000 that were returned in 86. And they were held in this appropriately imposing building that houses the Bavarian Army Museum. It was actually a 15th century fortress. And in the town of Ingolstadt, I teach Romantic literature too, and so what is Ingolstadt known best for in literary history? It's where Victor Frankenstein went to study and where he created his monster. So I'm always fascinated by this strange little irony of history that I find this material in Frankenstein's town. There's an entrance to the museum. And getting to see these works, this is one of the images on the website, Slot website, getting to see these works was astonishingly difficult because the director was very possessive of the material, but it required endless nights of drinking and eating heavy Bavarian food. And I'm serious. And listening to stories about his childhood in post-war Germany and Mickey Mouse and how much he loved Americans and all that sort of thing before I was allowed to see them and photograph them, but I was eventually able to do so. And this is another picture coming up by Ertel that reminds us more of... It's a fascinating picture because, of course, in technique-wise, it reminds us of maybe of Ertel's teacher, Munch, but it also has barbed wire here in the foreground. So we can see this actually was a... He was depicting a fortified beach or something in Norway. Astonishing picture. I saw this like, what? This is not what we expected to see, clearly. Or nor did one expect to see this kind of portrayal of a German soldier. When we think about go back to the one I showed earlier, In the Trenches, very heroic, sort of last stand kind of thing. Here we have someone is simply entitled Lanza or GI or whatever you might call it. Clearly he's got the thousand-yard stare. It's not what one expects at all in the representation of German fighting men at the time. This one is by an artist named Müller Lienau, and after the war, it's kind of hard to orient yourself here, but this is taken, this is a view from a ship in a convoy, and Müller Lienau had a very productive career after the war. Subject of my project on the last Taboo. This one is an interesting one too, by an artist named Bush, spelled differently than our Bush, of course. But it was unexpected. It was unexpected to find images sympathetic of the impact of German combat destruction. These are refugees in Russia. You can see the burnt out. These are the chimneys that are left of the huts and dwellings in the village, and these are the people left without shelter or any of their carrying bags of their worldly goods. I was really surprised to see this. It doesn't correspond to what one expected. Nor this picture by an artist named Recker, who this is depicting Hamburg after the firebombing. And it's, again, a kind of a haunting image. It's not heroic at all. And even though the Nazis did issue sort of commemorative bronze medallions that celebrated the steadfast opposition of the German people to the Allied attacks. This has a totally different feel from that. This one is by another artist named Agricola, Russian refugees. Little side story on that one. He was one of the few artists who successfully sued the German government for the return of his work. And this work is actually no longer a part of the German War Art Collection, as it's called. But it was gifted to the Bavarian Army Museum after his successful suit. Another portrait of a German soldier, not terribly heroic, by an artist. Again, I'm interested in those who had careers that both during the Weimar period and then after the war. And this is an artist named Imkamp, who was a very successful artist in the war, post-war years. He turned in the direction of abstract expressionism in the 50s, interesting character. This artist named Klumpies always provides in his pictures a kind of a comic relief, or he was sort of a successful illustrator before the war, and you can see here the details. There's an officer's cap, and this officer's gone for a dip in this pond. It sort of provide a kind of humanizing, almost comic relief in a lot of his images. This one also is quite surprising. I found in Ingolstadt, it's entitled Rainy Day by Meister. A lot of these are so large that I would have to stand on the table and somehow stand on a big table with my cameras, avoiding the cameras from dangling in front of me as I was taking pictures of them. They finally had pity on me. On the second visit, they gave me a ladder. And so I could stand, and the lighting was terrible, and you know, it's a miracle that these turned out the way they did. This is by an artist named Trundli of a town in the Crimea. I find it a pretty fascinating one. This is an action scene of a Russian airstrike against a German airfield. And it's really the technique in trying to portray the bombs exploding, the airplane up here coming apart in midair. These figures in the foreground observing all of this. It's quite horrifying, but interesting. One doesn't see images like this very often. Or of this image of German soldiers repelling a Soviet tank assault. Again, by an artist named Henselick. This artist, Hirel, had quite a career in the post-war era as well, and all of his images are sort of in this kind of style, which doesn't really accord with the what I call the court style of the Third Reich, but it's successful nonetheless. Or this image, which again shows tanks being blown up and soldiers, dead enemy soldiers being thrown out of the tank there. But surprisingly, it is a print of a vigorous style. This is an artist, Schmock again, of German soldiers here and Russian peasants there. Surprising image. Or this of, again, of peasants, of refugees. And there's a work party here going off in this direction. It's hard to determine exactly what this one was, but it could have been a fairly nasty moment. These guys could have been marched off to do some, you know, be treated horribly. And then there is another depot of work that I mentioned before. That's the U.S. Army's collection. We retained about 400 pictures in 1986. And the fascinating thing about this is that it included images. There were no art historians who served on the vetting committee for this decision. And so some pictures, this one is somewhat well known. It sort of fits our idea of National Socialist realism. But the following image is an interesting example. She was actually, the artist is a woman named Timon. She sent this image, it's entitled Farewell, to be judged to the jury for the planned 1945 Great German Art Exhibition, which of course didn't happen. And so it was left in the basement of the House of German Art until that American officer arrived in 1946, where he took it. And I found an amazing thing. I actually found her Fragenbogen, as well as her correspondence to the House of German Art. The Americans gave the authorities in the House of German Art 5 years to settle with all of the artists and purchasers of art from the shows. Imagine that, 5 years to just shut the thing down. And the correspondence I found is astonishing. Anyway, she writes in asking about this picture. So remember, at this time, there was no food in Germany, essentially, and people could use pictures as barter. So that's why she wanted her picture. And she mentioned, and she was told in a letter by the former accountant of the House of Art, who was retained as the head of this office that was getting rid of the property there. She said, well, I sent it there. I was surprised that it was selected for the exhibition. Of course, it didn't happen because of its quasi-anti-war or dissident sort of feel. And then the letter from the former accountant to the artist Timon indicates, well, I'm sorry, your picture was confiscated by Gordon Gilkey because it depicts soldiers. And so it also rests in Washington. It's never been exhibited, and it's one of those I'm going to select for the show in the Zimmerli. And all this is by way of, up till now, just to argue in favor of doing a different kind of show on the art of the Third Reich. I'm going to call it Modernism in the Third Reich, or at least that's the working title. And it's intended to be the most extensive show of its kind to date, more than 200 objects. And so it'll be both bigger and more diverse in content than the Achim Price's 1999 show in Weimar. And my objective is to bring together paintings from all of these different depots, in addition to a few selected pieces from the 700-piece National Socialist property collection. By contrast, as I hope I've made clear tonight, all exhibitions of Nazi art, starting with Kunst im Dritten Reich in 1974, have consisted solely of objects from this 700-piece collection, a rather limited group of objects, that was left in the custody of the West Germany, but under the authority of the U.S. Army. My exhibition will attempt to reveal just how limited a perspective this 700-piece collection gives us of artistic production during the Nazi dictatorship, and will emphasize previously unseen works of art, many of which suggest that modernist techniques of figuration and representation have not been completely extinguished by the degenerate art exhibition of 1937 and the persecution of so-called degenerate artists. So that's the argument, and one could argue, too, that 700 versus 10,000 is fairly disproportionate. Up till now, our judgment's been based on only 700 works, and I'm hoping that with these 10,000 works that will be, over the course of time, sort of injected into the argument, made available for scholars, that we might revisit the whole question of what, in fact, cultural production was in the Third Reich. So that's the end of this show, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yes? Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's an excellent question. Yes. Well, one of the things that happened is after the war is that both degenerate artists, quote-unquote degenerate artists, classical modernists who were thrown out of work starting in the 30s, as well as quote-unquote Nazi artists who may have been thrown out of work initially in 45, all of them resumed their jobs after 49 or even before that. And many of them, fascinating enough, it's astonishing to think about, but some of the so-called degenerate artists who stayed in Germany were not persecuted because of their race or religion or their politics, continued to share studios with quote-unquote Nazi artists throughout the war. They'd been colleagues, they'd been friends, they'd been in school together. So yes, there was a, that's the point of The Last Taboo, the book that I'm doing after The Invisible Museum, is to trace this process of rehabilitation and of artists who were successful both in Weimar and in the Third Reich. I've just uncovered the tip of the iceberg, but it makes for a really fascinating story. There are plenty of theorists like Benjamin Buchlow and others who speculate on the sort of late arrival of abstract expressionism in Germany. Why might that be? You know, what is holding back the arrival of movements that occurred in New York and Paris and London? Well, it's look who's in the artist establishment. The people who served in the juries during the Third Reich were serving on the juries in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. In fact, if you go... The Last Taboo is going to focus on the House of Art as well, but the same guys who served in the juries in the 40s are serving on the juries all the way through the 70s, and so they're making their selections well. So it's a fascinating kind of story. Yeah. Yes.
Was the idea of confiscating the work to punish the Germans, to prevent these works from serving as future propaganda,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had the opportunity to actually interview the officer before his death, and one of the things that I had to do was imagine just how hated the Germans were after World War II, and part of it was just this absolute hatred for all they stood for. And as an artist, Gilkey was deeply identified with classical modernism, and in a sense, what he had done is he'd internalized the split between modernism and Nazi art that the Nazis had created. And so he, on the one hand, he would help classical modernist artists that he was able to help. And on the other hand, one of the things I learned is they not only confiscated objects that were found in public buildings or in hiding places, but he also would have a technique for clearing out artist studios. He would call them up and say, I'm so-and-so, I'm a fellow artist, an American officer, I'd love to invite you to lunch, I love your work. And while they were out to lunch, and again, food, really important. Really important at this time, he would send people working under him to clear out their studios.
And
they'd be gone. And that's the reason why Agricola won his suit, one of the artists, is because he was smart enough that one of his assistants had, while he was out to lunch, had the Americans give him a receipt, no lie. I found the whole argument, I found a copy of the receipt in the papers, and so because he had a receipt that the Americans had given him, he was finally able to get access to his works. So, but it was punitive. The Americans also planned, before the onset of the Cold War, to build a huge museum in Washington devoted to anti-fascism. And so these works, Gilkey was under the impression these works would be shown in a museum of anti-fascism. We also had a collection, art confiscation unit working in Japan. And Gilkey was supposed to go to Italy, but for political reasons, they decided to let the Italians off the hook. But so this was what his thinking was, there would be a big museum. But of course, Cold War realities being what they were, the Germans very quickly became our allies. And there was another issue that was a problem too about these works, is that when they arrived in Washington shortly after early 1951, the last of them, it was determined that Gilkey's confiscation actions were illegal. Because after 46, the Germans had regained their private property rights. And so it was a political snafu, hence the return in 51 of about 1,700 works that were deemed to be kind of harmless. So lots of conflicting impulses, feelings, motivations. There was a very gray area legally of what there was being done. But it was clear that American, I found the correspondence, inter-office correspondence, where the Army JAG officers are saying, what on earth are we doing? This is not legal. So, oh yeah. Yes.
I mean, you've shown very, very convincingly that there was something like the Nazi modernism. How could it be allowed to survive? Would you say that it was perhaps because of clashes between various groups, Hitler being maybe more conservative than Goering?
Absolutely. We all know that, you know, the tendency of scholarship, historiography of Nazi Germany is that it was not a monolithic state, that there were, the whole organization of the state was such that there was duplication and rivalry were at the heart of it. And though I'm not going to go into that in great detail in my work, but that I think is an explanation. And the fact that the Wehrmacht, the armed forces, was a place where artists felt freer. And the thing that's so weird is that these pictures I showed you, every one of them was sold to an army installation, to a museum. They were actually hanging in museums. And they were taken out of frames and out of stretchers, a lot of them, when I found they were all lying flat. But they had clearly been taken out of their frames and stretchers, those that were on canvas. And so, yes, rivalry. We realize that one of the things we have to remember, too, about the House of Art is that it's only one institution, and the one institution has come to stand for the entire phenomenon. And one of the things I did at the Wolfsonian, which was interesting, was to study regional art exhibitions. And these Wolfson acquired hundreds and hundreds of art catalogs. And you can see that, for example, Christian Schott, who's considered one of the martyrs of modern German art, was actually exhibited until 1941 openly. So he's seen as a degenerate artist on the one hand, but he was still able to do his kind of new objectivity portraiture into the early 40s. And because of it, he wasn't Jewish and he wasn't a communist, he was able to sort of fit in and pass. And so I think that we need to recognize that Munich was just one site for the display of this material, and there were conflicting and at times totally contradictory interpretations of what was possible or not. No. Sorry. True.
And so forth. So cubism is not there. So there were nonetheless certain limits.
Precisely.
You would
well, the other thing too is that my work is focused on only 10,000 works that were collected by one guy in a discrete kind of action over a period of months. One of the facts that's really compelling is there are about 15,000 registered artists in 1933 in Germany, and there are about 15,000 artists who submitted work to the House of German Art competitions throughout the 40s. The number of professional artists didn't really change. People were still being churned out of the art schools, and so there was a kind of a static number. Now, one thing to consider, too, we asked ourselves, how many artists were included in the Degenerate Art Exhibition? Only 112. Now, they accounted for a disproportionate number of works. Nolde was very productive, right? So of the 16,000 or so works that were confiscated, initially by Ziegler and Willrich and people they inspired, several thousand would be by Nolde himself. Okay, so we need to realize too that this was a sort of compartmentalized and not complete, and what even the definition of degenerate art as revealed in the 1937 show is also incomplete. So again, I'm talking about a discrete collection that I was able to find. And I'm not trying to draw any greater conclusions. There are things missing. Certainly it's not, right, there are certain things that were definitely taboo. But there's more to be found, no doubt. In fact, the director of the German Historical Museum was in Versailles. He was on that commission that was dealing with the renovation of the Versailles. And in the storeroom of the Versailles, there were these big German Nazi German canvases that were just hanging around, that were there, taken as plunder by French forces. So there's just tons of material there. And I drew the line. I said, no, I don't want, no, this is done. I'm not going to make a career of this. But, yeah. So I'll come to the show in 2010. There'll be plenty of publicity about that. Thank you very much. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them, too.